You inevitably read a win as people saying, you're great, you should do what you've been talking about throughout this campaign. That's what we'd love to see. And to read the narrow wins that both parties have had for most of this century that way is ultimately a way to make yourself the next unpopular incumbent.
Is Trumpism America's governing ideology? Just asking questions. I'm Zach Weissmuller, senior producer for Reason, joined by my co-host, Reason Associate Editor Liz Wolf. Hey, Liz.
Hey, Zach.
Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone that we have launched our YouTube channel, a new YouTube channel. We're still a part of Reason, but we wanted to create a place where people who come to YouTube specifically to watch Just Asking Questions have a way to subscribe and interact with our show. We'll still release on Thursdays. Okay, so Trump won decisively by modern standards, meaning for the first time in several cycles, nobody is seriously disputing the results. But did he really win bigly? Does he have a governing mandate? Today's guest says not really. Yuval Levin is the director of social, cultural, and constitutional studies at the American Enterprise Institute and the editor of National Affairs. He co-authored a paper published just before the election, I'll pull it up here, called Politics Without Winners, about the inability of either Democrats or the GOP to build a lasting governing coalition in the 21st century. Yuval, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you recently, as I was mentioning there, published some of your thoughts. Published that paper, but you also published some of your thoughts recently in The Dispatch in an article headlined, What Trump's Win Doesn't Mean. I pulled a line from there that I thought was interesting. You said that the 2024 election was very much of a piece with our 21st century politics. It was a relatively narrow win, owed almost entirely to negative polarization. So we'll dig into that negative polarization in a minute, but what is the significance of Trump, to you, of Trump winning a fairly slim majority with a substantial number of voters seemingly motivated to vote against Harris as opposed to for Trump?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that this is how most voters have thought about most elections for the last 25 years, which is they're reacting against the status quo and arguing that what they want to see is not what they're getting. And the challenge that this poses for both parties is that it's hard to read a win that way. You inevitably read a win as people saying, you're great, you should do what you've been talking about throughout this campaign. That's what we'd love to see. And to read the narrow wins that both parties have had for most of this century that way is ultimately a way to make yourself the next unpopular incumbent. Voters are reacting to what they don't like about the status quo. Parties interpret that as them liking what their party activists want. And then you end up with presidents who use the power of their office to make their own party unpopular. That's really been the story of 21st century American politics. And it's very hard to get away from it without thinking differently about the task of building electoral coalitions. And you see it. You see it happening now in the wake of the election. The people around Trump naturally inclined to say, well, we won pretty decisively, and they did. It's not that close an election. But the idea that that therefore means that what the public wants to see is what they've been talking about is not well supported by the results. And that's a complicated place for a political coalition to be in.
Well, so I'm a little skeptical of this thesis, in part because, I mean, we saw the GOP, you know, they won the House. They won the Senate. There's a very clear majority. And it's not totally clear to me that the Democrats will have a good path to retaking the Senate specifically in the midterms. Given these facts, I mean, did they, in fact, earn a governing mandate?
So, look, they won majorities. That means they can try to do what they want to do. They won the House. I would say they kept the House, probably just about exactly the same majority they had before, which is a very narrow majority. By historical standards, the average House majority in the last half of the 20th century was 84 seats. The average in this century has been 23 seats. This House majority is probably going to be 3, maybe 4 seats. that's a very close election. That's what that has to tell you. It doesn't mean they're intensely unpopular. The other party didn't win by a big margin, but it does raise a question about whether they have the majorities they need to do much of anything. I think it's true Republicans are reasonably likely to keep the Senate in the next midterm because of the races that are up. They're only really defending in a couple of places, in Maine, I would say, above all, maybe in North Carolina. And so the map favors them, and I think they are likely to keep their Senate majority. They'd have to be very unpopular for that to change. But again, the question is, what are they as a party supposed to make of the results of this election, and what are they supposed to do with it? Our political parties used to answer that question in a very different way than they do now. The logic had been that you build your electoral majority in power. That is, you use your office to make your party more popular by using the power that comes with government to broaden your electoral reach, to speak to more voters, to serve their interests, to provide them with things that they will then take to be reasons to vote for you. We've come to a place now where the parties tend to use their time and power to satisfy their activists out of a sense that it won't last, and therefore to narrow their majorities. And almost every president and congressional majority now is less popular 2 years after being elected than they were on election day. That's not the general trend in American political life, and I think it's a function exactly of the 50-50 politics we're seeing. It makes it hard for our political coalitions to know exactly what to do when they do win power. And those coalitions have both struggled, really, with how to grow since the beginning of the 21st century. I think I'd put it this way. Generally, at any given moment in American history, you would find a clear majority party that's working to sustain a broad coalition and hold it together, and a minority party that's working to grow its coalition. Both of those parties are engaged in coalition building. Since the 1990s, we've had two minority parties that are both engaged in intensifying their own supporters' commitment. And that's a different kind of effort than coalition building. And we've therefore been stuck at 50-50 for quite a while, even as the electoral coalitions of the parties have been changing under the surface.
It feels like part of the reason why both parties have struggled with coalition building has to do with internal identity crisis. Are the leadership battles that we're seeing, the sort of squabbles, which have really occupied a lot of the news media for the last few years, and now it looks like we're going to do more of that, is that a sign? Is that evidence that bolsters your thesis that, like, actually these parties kind of don't really know what they're all about anymore?
Well, I'd say so in part. I think what it suggests is that they don't think of themselves in coalitional terms. So leadership fights are always fights, but parties understand themselves to be a coalition of different interests. So different parts of the party have their own priorities and disagree with each other, but are engaged in a continuing negotiating process that holds them together. The 50-50 dynamic that we've been living with has made both parties more internally cohesive and therefore less tolerant of internal coalition politics than they were before. And so the struggle is, which one of us factions within the Republican or Democratic Party owns the whole thing? Who actually controls the party? Rather than how do we negotiate an arrangement by which we are both in the same party and have different interests that we can both advance? I think the parties have lost the knack for that kind of coalition building, and so have become much less tolerant of internal dissent. Leadership elections in Congress are taken to be kind of crisis moments now. I think they should be understood to be much more normal than we now think of them as being.
If you had to break down roughly what you think the coalition within the GOP is right now, what would that be? And do you have a sense as to which one of those factions is ascendant?
So I think one way to think about the two-party coalitions now is to see that American politics is always divided along two kinds of axes. One is a familiar left-right axis, which has to do with different views of the role of government, but ultimately different views of, in a sense, the purpose of politics. The other I would describe as an up-down axis, which is the elite and populist axis of American politics, which is always there, which in some ways is actually the older way of thinking about politics. The ancients called it the few and the many. That's still very much a part of our politics. And there are times when left and right matters a lot more. I think for most of the 20th century, that was the case. There are times when up and down matters a lot more. And that's been true in the 21st century. Our politics now is much more about populism and elitism than it is about left and right. The coalition of the right is still a coherent thing. In the Cold War years, it was understood, I think, rightly as a coalition of social conservatives and economic capitalists and foreign policy hawks.
Mm-hmm.
These are different groups. They were unified by the fact that the Soviet Union hated all of them, and that held the party together.
Anti-communism was the uniting thing.
Yeah, they all shared a kind of anti-communism. I think they're united by more than that, but that certainly held them together very firmly. And the right, in the wake of the Cold War, has gone through a series of attempts to reconceive the organizing principle of the coalition. What now holds us together? And therefore, also, who is the most powerful of the factions? Who matters most? I think we've seen a number of efforts to elevate social conservatives above the more economic libertarians in the party. George W. Bush was an example of that. We may not think of him that way now, but I think that's what he was to begin with. There was an effort to do that in the Obama years, out of power. And I think in some ways, Trump is also an example of that, where a lot of his coalition consists of people who understand themselves to be advancing a cultural message and who are less libertarian about economics and less concerned with government action. I think all of these efforts have failed more or less as an attempt to build a broad, durable coalition. And the right has not become the majority coalition in this period. The left also is not, and it's had its own challenges in the post-Cold War world. But I think the difficulty the right has had in understanding itself as engaged in coalition building has been especially acute in the Trump years, for a distinct reason that has to do with Donald Trump, which is, generally speaking, coalition building within a political party looks like, this is what I want, and I'm willing to give you something in return. What do you want? In the Trump years, everybody has had to emphasize what they agree about with Donald Trump. And so to say very loudly, we both think this, and to say nothing at all about what we disagree about. The disagreements are still there. The factions still exist. The right still consists, as any political coalition would, of distinct factions, but the differences are not talked about within the Republican coalition in the way that they normally would be. And that makes it much more difficult to exactly see where the lines are, what the differences are. So you've got people around the president-elect now who are hawks and doves, who are more libertarian about economics and more activist about economics, all at the same time. Cultural radicals and cultural traditionalists all at the same time, and they don't want to talk about what they disagree about. It's very hard for a coalition to work that way, and I think that's part of the kind of peculiarity of this moment on the right.
Yeah, so if the sort of uniting principle now, rather than anti-communism, is fealty to Donald Trump, or at least like spoken fealty to Donald Trump, I'm curious about what the polls say about Americans' evaluation of Donald Trump as a person. I mean, he won 50% of the popular vote, and yet the exit polling shows that the American people's evaluation of his character is still not great. Right here, we see the question asked by AP Votecast, which started asking these questions before the election, all the way through the election and a little bit after the election, found that across all age demographics, the majority of respondents said they would not say Donald Trump is honest and trustworthy. Same result when you ask, would you say Donald Trump has the moral character to be president? And then, quite interestingly, if you look at people who voted for Donald Trump, 21% of them who voted for Donald Trump would not say he's honest and trustworthy. And 16% of people who voted for Donald Trump would say he does not have the moral character to be president. What do you make of these kind of results? What does it say about a political moment?
Right. I mean, I think it suggests something about how people prioritize these questions. Trump, as you say, won the popular vote. I think he'll probably end up with a little less than 50% of the vote, but more than Kamala Harris's vote. And yet large portions of his own electorate, meaningful portions, very large portions of the overall electorate, think he doesn't have the moral character to be president. I think part of what that tells you is that we now, in the Trump era at least, are downplaying the importance of character for the presidency. I think that's very worrisome. I think character is enormously important in the presidency, more so than in any other office in our national politics. The president as an individual has a huge amount of power, and it is very important that that person have some responsibility. I don't think that's a word a lot of people would use about Donald Trump, but a lot of this is an expression of negative polarization. That is, what it means now to be the leader of one of the parties is to own the banner of opposition to the other party, and to therefore to support that person is to oppose the other party. And that's where a lot of voters end up coming down when they make their decision. They're trying to decide what they need to prevent as much as what they want to advance. And a lot of our partisanship now is negative partisanship. It's not enthusiasm for the platform of the Republican Party. It's an intense sense that the Democrats have failed. And in the last election, the Democrats won by an even larger margin in the popular vote, somewhat smaller in the Electoral College. And similarly, I think that was not a statement of public enthusiasm for whatever was Joe Biden's agenda in the election, but a sense that they wanted a change at the top. It's just very hard for either party to read the result that way. And so they end up getting themselves in trouble.
I have another question about the peculiar circumstances of Donald Trump's re-election, because he is only the second president in history to lose re-election and then come back again. The last one to do it was Grover Cleveland. I pulled this. This, I believe, is a handkerchief.
Right.
And interestingly, it shows
one election was all about tariffs. Yeah.
Was all about tariffs, although Cleveland was on the opposite side of Trump on that issue. But, you know, looking at history, what happened to, you know, he was running as a Democrat. What happened to the Democratic Party after Grover Cleveland won re-election after taking one term off? And what does it portend, if anything, for a post-Trump GOP?
Well, you know, that period at the end of the 19th century should be very interesting to us, because it's the only other period in the history of the American party system where you had an extended back and forth between the parties in control of the presidency and of Congress. You had just about a 20-year period. We've already been through a longer one now, but about a 20-year period where everything was at stake in every election. Every election could go either way. It's the only other time where we've had three presidential elections in which the incumbent loses in a row. So that the Democrats lost, the Republicans came in, they lost the next time, the Democrats then lost, the Republicans came in. And it looked like this. The Democrats ended up responding to an election loss by running the same person again and winning. There are other similarities. That was also a period where American politics went through a real legitimacy crisis. A lot of elections were disputed. Elections were extremely close. There were two elections in that period in which the winner of the popular vote and the electoral vote were not the same, just as we've had two such elections in the 21st century. Intense disputes that ended up leading to the passage of the Electoral Count Act, which became a big issue, of course, in 2020. That was enacted after the 1876 election in that period. So that was a period that felt like a failure of the party system, where you had two minority parties for an extended period of time. It ended with this return of the non-consecutive presidential terms of Grover Cleveland. It didn't end well for Grover Cleveland. So that period it was followed by a genuine transformational election in which William McKinley really created the new Republican coalition that then went on to dominate American politics until the New Deal, until the Great Depression ran. 30 years of politics dominated by the opposite party is what followed. I don't think that means that that'll happen here necessarily. It would require the Democrats to respond to this moment by building a broad coalition. I don't think that would be easy for them. But it does suggest that the equilibrium of 50-50 need not be permanent, that it is possible after a long period in which we seem to be stuck at 50-50 for one of the parties to build a genuinely broad coalition in a new way. The Republicans in that period responded to demographic changes, responding to economic changes, technological changes, by drawing together a group of urban workers and rural voters in a way that had not been done before. And I think it took a kind of political talent and imagination. That's the sort of thing it would require for us to break the 50-50 deadlock too.
You know you're on a libertarian podcast because we're like chomping at the bit to ask you about Grover Cleveland, right? Like, we're so excited. But you mentioned something.
Yeah,
you mentioned something that I think is really interesting, and it's been a huge thing that's discussed, I think, in a very stupid way, frankly, in American politics for the last 2 years, which is the sort of legitimacy crisis and commentary that happens when there's a mismatch between the Electoral College results and the popular vote results. To me, maybe this is because of a libertarian autistic brain tick or something, but it always strikes me as a little bit odd that people have such an issue with this, because the Electoral College is the system that we have. And so, okay, popular vote results are interesting, sure,
right,
but the Electoral College is the system that we go by. And so therefore, that is the result that matters. But regardless of how I feel about it, there's clearly this sense of a legitimacy crisis that happens when there is a mismatch there. And it seems like, especially of late, I mean, we don't fully know the popular vote results from this past election, but at least, you know, in 2020 and before, like, you know, this is a thing that really wrinkles a lot of people. What do you, am I, convince me that the Electoral College popular vote mismatch really matters the way that people claim it does.
Well, I only think it matters because people think it matters, right? I certainly agree with you that ultimately the system we have is the Electoral College. That's how people run. That's how they campaign. That's how they think
the
about what voters
strategy
they need.
Is crafted around this, right?
Absolutely. Like, if we had a popular vote. So the closest thing we have to a national popular vote is the popular vote for the House of Representatives, which doesn't look like the presidential popular vote at all. Republicans have won the popular vote for the House. I think it's now 13 out of the last 15 times. That's not what the 21st century has looked like in terms of presidential elections, because they run differently. I mean, it's just that simple. Elections are very close. They would still be close if they were popular vote elections, but they would be run differently and they would end differently. I think the popular vote result for president is simply an incidental byproduct of the actual election. And so I certainly don't think that it should matter. But look, people will say more people voted for the other guy. Why is this one becoming president? It's not impossible to understand. The mismatch only happens in close elections. And so what we're really saying when there's a mismatch is that the election was very, very close. And close elections are always a challenge for legitimacy. What happens in a very close election is really a test of our commitment to the law more than a test of public preferences. The result is tied. And so we just have to be committed to the process and say, however this ends, that person is going to have the power of elected office, because this is how our system works, not because the public is enthusiastic to get him or her into office. That's a very hard thing to do. And as we saw in 2020, it's easy to start making legitimacy arguments. I would say both parties have done this in the 21st century. The result, after 2016, there were a lot of Democrats who said, actually, the Russians stole the election. This didn't really happen. After 2020, of course, the president himself said that the election result wasn't legitimate. I think we're avoiding that this time. I'm happy to see it. I think part of that is a gift given to us by the Electoral College, which is the result seems like a bigger win than it is. Trump will probably end up with about 49.9% of the vote. I think Harris will have about 48 point something. That's a very close election. It looks less close because of the Electoral College, and I think that's a good thing.
Because Trump won all of the swing states, and it was so decisive.
That's right. Now, each of them was close, right? So the overall national popular vote is very close. But yeah, because he won the swing states.
Well, so are we coming out of this electoral results legitimacy crisis? I mean, obviously, it's a little early to tell, but like, did we have turbulence that we, in fact, appear to have weathered?
Well, I think in this case, it does feel that way in this election. I don't think we've come out of the 50-50 moment in our politics. Again, a 49-48 election suggests we haven't, and it is very close. I think it would take a very small swing for things to go the other way. And so at this point, I would say we're still in a place where there's not a popular, a clear electoral majority coalition. But it does seem to me that there is a path for Republicans to follow that could help them get there. They've seen a kind of depolarization in some of the electorates they've been trying to reach for a long time. Some of that is a return to a pre-Obama norm. You know, Republicans are very excited to win 42% of the Hispanic vote. They actually won 46% of the Hispanic vote in 2004. So, you know, this is a return to a pre-Obama form of racial depolarization. I think they're rightly excited to get more Black voters. That has not happened before, at least in modern times, and that's very important. But they need to find ways to win these new voters while keeping their old voters, and neither party has really managed to do that very well.
I want to pull us a little back further, even a little further back in history to explore our current moment. Because America's first major wave of populism happened with Andrew Jackson, and you describe that the partisan divide in your paper this way. You say one of the parties which formed around Andrew Jackson was populist, committed to resisting the power of elites, bankers, and industrialists to advance the common American's interests. The other party feared Jackson would usher in an age of demagogues and advanced instead an agenda of modernization and national greatness that evinced far greater trust in elites, industrialization, and the emerging market economy. This is the Democrats versus the Whigs. Is this in any way similar to the situation we face today?
Well, I think it's tempting to think so because that was another moment where up-down mattered more than left-right. The left-right divide that you could have seen in the early Republic, the divide between the Federalists and the Democrats, really all but disappeared. And the Democrats, the Jeffersonians, won in a big way so that the Federalists essentially ceased to exist. And this reached a peak in the 1824 election, in which there were four major candidates, and they were all Democrats. Two of them had the same running mate. In fact, the two leading candidates had the same vice presidential candidate. A very bizarre election. And ultimately, the divide that emerged within the one party that America had for a little while, the Democratic Party, was an elite populist divide, much more than it was a left-right divide. And you had for a time a kind of elite party, the Whig Party around John Quincy Adams, and a very populist party in the age of Jackson. Those parties did, in time, come to return to a sort of left-right divide. And I think there's no avoiding entirely the left-right divide in American political life. But it's worth our seeing the historical abnormality we're living through now. Generally speaking, the party of the left has been the populist party in American political life. The party of the right has been the elitist party. We're living in a time now, and there have been a few moments like this, but not an extended period, where the party of the right is populist, the party of the left is elitist. I think that contributes quite a bit to the confusion of this moment in our political life. It's hard for conservatives to be populists. Those are two opposite attitudes about American institutions. It's hard for progressives to be elitists. Those are two opposite attitudes about power, and they complicate our politics very dramatically. Neither party is quite comfortable with the position it has, and I would say the Democrats are especially uncomfortable now with being the party of the elite. They still see themselves as the rebels, and they are not the rebels. They run all the institutions. To run the institutions means to take some responsibility for them. And I think some of the trouble of the modern left has to do with an unwillingness to take responsibility for the power they actually have. At the same time, the right can't decide if it wants to burn down the institutions or defend them. And that's a confused place to be, too.
You wrote a wonderful book called The Great Debate, which sets up some of this conflict. I mean, it's about Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine and the degree to which the modern left and right really are in some ways represented by this very fundamental philosophical divide present at our founding. In your eyes, who best represents the idea of Burke? Who best represents the idea of Paine in our current political moment? And would Trump really be considered Burkean in any way whatsoever?
No, I don't think so. Not that I can see. I think those left-right distinctions still matter a lot, and that on the whole, the Republican Party is still where you would find most of the people who are inclined to be traditionalists and to understand institutions as necessary for the formation of a free human person. The left is still where you would find most of the people who are inclined to think about politics in terms of oppressor and oppressed, as my friend Arnold Kling put it in a wonderfully clarifying way, and where the basic distinction between powerful and powerless is taken to be the organizing principle of our politics. Left-right, therefore, still matter. They're still coherent, but the populist right is much less Burkean than the conservative right. And there's always been an element of populism in the American right, but it's not really been the dominant element until the 21st century. And I think the Trumpist right is certainly less conservative than the Republican Party of the second half of the 20th century was. There's a coalition here, and there are tensions between conservatives and libertarians. Again, I think there's an unwillingness to acknowledge those tensions, but my inclination is always to acknowledge those tensions. I'm a conservative. I'm very uncomfortable with Donald Trump as a leader of the right. I can certainly see how it's valuable to stop the left and its excesses, but I worry about the tendency to have an unmitigated populism be the face of the American right, because it's precisely a danger to American institutions and to traditionalism.
Well, detail that for us a little bit. Why does Donald Trump so offend your Burkean sensibilities, which, by the way, I think I share?
Well, look, I think that he operates without a respect for the institutions of American life. And the core Burkean insight is that we require these institutions to be formative of the kind of citizen our society needs to remain a free society.
So.
The institutions that form us are not fundamentally political. They're first of all family and church and school and community, but they are also political. The institutions of our constitutional system are formative of American citizens. And I think those institutions require a particular kind of leader. Republicanism, small r republicanism, requires a certain kind of citizen that takes responsibility for public problems and a certain kind of leader that takes responsibility for power. And I think none of that speaks to Donald Trump's temperament, to his inclinations, to his instincts. He is opposed to the left, and in that we agree. But when it comes to what he wants to do, to what he wants to build, to what he wants to see created in the world, I guess I just don't take him to be a conservative. And he's more or less said that. I mean, in running in 2016, he said, look, this is not the conservative party, it's the Republican party. That's true. That party needs to be a coalition of conservatives and populists, it seems to me, if it's going to be a force for good.
Is there something that is just doomed about Burkean politics in our national politics? Because it's like, if your message, what seems to win, at least in the 21st century presidential elections I've observed, is we're the party of change. The party before us was bad. We need to bring some sort of revolution. That's a very Thomas Paine type idea. It's never like we need to like preserve all the great things about the status quo and maybe like slightly improve things around the edges. Like, is there any hope whatsoever for a Burkean resurgence of that kind?
Well, Burkeanism is a mode of change. I think conservatism itself is a mode of change, an approach to how change should happen. And it tends to think that change should happen in decentralized ways and from the bottom up. I do think that's an argument you can make to the American public. That kind of conservative is always going to be one voice. I don't think it's likely to be the dominant political voice in American society. We are a society founded in a self-conscious revolution. We are, from the very beginning, a society much more future-oriented than tradition-oriented. I think that's one of the great things about us. But it's exactly that kind of society that requires the balancing, that needs to be balanced by a kind of Burkean conservatism. That sort of conservatism is not backward-looking. It's not continental European conservatism. It's not blood and soil conservatism. It's about a conservation of the preconditions for freedom. And those preconditions are permanent, I think. They do need to endure. But they are preconditions for progress. They're preconditions for constructive change, too. So I think that kind of conservatism can certainly make a case for itself in American political life. It's not always going to be dominant. It's one of the voices that has to hold our politics in balance. But I think for that reason, it is important that it be a key part of what the party of the right in American political life has to say. And it's not enough so today.
Yeah, when you talk about Burke's theory of social change, you're really speaking my language. I mean, I'm Hayekian, as are a lot of people at Reason. And I've always kind of looked at Hayek as almost a synthesis of elements of Burke and Paine. He shares Paine's Enlightenment commitment to empiricism, and he puts the individual at the center of his political philosophy and his economic analysis. But he's also a Chesterton's fence respecter. Like, you better not tear down something without understanding why it's there. What do you think of Hayek?
I agree with that. I think Hayek calls himself an old Whig, which is which is Burke's term for himself and his party. And I think that's right. He's not simply a Burkean. He's a bit of a moral relativist, or at least he seems that way at the opening of the Constitution of Liberty, which I think is where he's most explicit about these points. He distances himself from Paine. You know, he's got that long list of people who belong on the French side of the English-French divide, the French side being the side he's against. And there are a number of English people on that side, and one of them is Tom Paine. And so I think Hayek wants to say that's not his view of how change happens. And he puts himself very much on Team Burke and Team Smith, which I think are related teams. But Hayek is not exactly a Burkean. You know, Burke has a much more religious disposition than that, and is ultimately not a relativist. And so I think Burke is not quite a libertarian, but he's certainly a believer in a notion of change and progress that is fundamentally bottom-up, that says change is never contained in anybody's mind. There's no technocrat who knows the answers. Knowledge is contained in society's institutions. And that means the only way we can benefit from society's knowledge is by working and living through those institutions. I think Hayek develops that idea in even greater depth and in ways that to me seem very much like expanding on Burke's insights.
Yeah, you're gesturing at the knowledge problem, which at least to me, I mean, maybe this is just a very libertarian thing to think and feel, but it always strikes me as one of the single best arguments against, you know, any sort of centralized state power, this idea of how on earth could you possibly expect central planners to carry out what you deem best? Like, how could they possibly have all of the knowledge necessary in order to design such a thing top down? And at least when I read Burke and when I read Hayek, I see this like shared skepticism of that idea and this incredible ability to cogently articulate the folly in that. I mean, it's something that feels like a lot of leftists really just fundamentally don't understand.
I think it's absolutely right. It's implicit in Burke. I think Burke saw it, but Hayek, of course, articulates it very explicitly and makes it very clear. It does seem to me that there's every reason to think that a lot of Burke's basic disposition. Now, he didn't confront technocracy in the 20th and 21st century since, so it's a little hard for us to know exactly what he would have thought of it. But he certainly thought that society's knowledge is contained in tradition, and that tradition is not a set of beliefs, but a set of practices. And that means that it's ultimately a set of institutions. That's very much akin to Hayek's kind of insight.
I mean, is there a sense in which Trump does have some of these Burkean instincts in that on some issues, he seems to be a federalist? Like, the abortion issue, for instance, but that's not the only one. He wants to abolish the Department of Education and he seems much more comfortable than previous presidents, even previous Republican presidents, in letting the states and localities handle issues. You know, maybe that's an outgrowth of him being a businessman and being willing to delegate things. Is that perhaps like an underrated Burkean instinct within Trump?
Well, I think perhaps is doing a lot of work there.
Fair enough.
I'm not sure. I don't think I really see that. I think his Federalist view on abortion is convenient, it seems to me.
It's cop-out Federalism, right?
Yeah, he doesn't have that view about crime. He doesn't have that view about a variety of other things. And I don't know what he thinks about the Department of Education, because on the one hand, there's a lot of things he wants to do with it. And on the other hand, he says he wants to get rid of it. So I'm not sure which of those wins out.
Yeah, he somehow wants to abolish it, yet also implement prayer in school. So I'm not sure how that all adds up.
Yeah, or even just, you know, create new accreditors for higher education. Well, that happens in the Department of Education. So I think you do ultimately have to decide whether there's a federal role here or not. And he, at least in education, has certainly taken both sides of that question at the same time.
Payne was a revolutionary, but you've written that the revolutionaries in today's left really seek to liberate the individual without necessarily grounding in principle and natural right the way that Payne would have expected. How would a grounded left look different than the type of progressive movement we see today?
Well, I think that ultimately Payne has a fundamental conviction that human beings are equal, and that this has to be a constraint on all uses of power, including government power. Payne is not of the view that liberation means liberation from interdependence, and that it can be achieved, therefore, by uses of government power and government resources. He's a radical of a different sort. I think that he is truly a kind of radical liberationist. He thinks the human person is free, and that the only reason we ever find unfree people is that they're being oppressed by institutions that make them unfree. The modern left is connected with a very different way of thinking about government, and therefore with a very different way of thinking about society and its institutions. They're related. I don't think they're completely unconnected. And I think there is a through line from Payne to a certain kind of modern progressivism. But they are different. And the commitment to basic natural rights, which you find in Payne as an absolute conviction, I mean, there's no question that he believes it to be true, is just not evident to me in contemporary progressivism.
It seems like this sort of like positive negative rights distinction that used to be something that was discussed quite frequently has really been lost among today's left. I mean, you see in so much of the popular discussion this idea of really expecting the government to provide pretty much everything to you, and increasingly moving toward it being universalized versus means tested. It's like we first had this idea of, you know, there are some things that the government should, you know, not bother you with and not do to you. And there are some things that the government should, in fact, you know, affirm, you know, proactively provide to you. And then we shifted toward an era where we really thought about things as like, okay, well, the government will have provision of certain social safety net, you know, things. But it will all be means tested. And there will be this idea that we must provide only for the truly indigent, but not for everyone, because, you know, why should everyone be reliant on the state? And now it feels like the modern left is like, forgive my student loans. And how dare you possibly attempt to have any oversight over why I got the degree, how I got these loans, what I'm doing with it now. Where do we go from here? Is this idea of restraint, or this idea that maybe the government doesn't need to be absolutely everything and provide absolutely everything to you, is it just lost forever among the left?
Well, I think that there's a peculiar kind of confusion of dependence and independence in this thinking about the role of government. So that I think a lot of people on the left see themselves as making an argument for individual independence. And what they mean is that people would not be dependent on others, especially on people they know, for meeting their basic needs. And government can step in from a distance, provide for those needs, and therefore allow you to make individual decisions in any way you want to without being accountable to anybody else who has any power over you. That's what liberation looks like to a lot of the modern left. It is a form of individualism. It does suggest a kind of ability to make free choices. But I think that it's a profoundly confused idea of what independence and freedom actually involve. There is no getting away from dependence. We all depend on other people. And oftentimes, that dependence can be valuable and enriching and elevating if it is connected with some degree of responsibility. To separate ourselves from one another as radically as the modern left tries to do, I think is ultimately destructive of social bonds and therefore of social institutions and therefore of social life. To me, that's less about the role of government. I don't think the big problem there is the size of government, though that is a problem. The problem there is the conception of social life that's implicit in the idea that you're only free when you're absolutely independent of all other human beings. That doesn't sound like freedom to me. That actually sounds like misery. I think that ultimately, to facilitate modes of interdependence that are elevating and enriching, like family and community and friendship, looks more like what a healthy society does. In some ways, that could involve government. In some ways, it ought not to. But I think the question of the role and size of government is not the most fundamental question. The most fundamental question is about really the nature of human flourishing. It's the oldest question there is in political philosophy, and it's still as relevant as ever.
One tension in the modern left that I really see is when you ask fellow taxpayers and fellow citizens to pick up the bill for your choices or to attempt to sort of mitigate the consequences that come from your choices.
Right.
You fundamentally are inviting their input in some way or another. And there's the sense of, you know, I ought to have total ability to use the funds that you contributed by nature of your hard work in the form of government funding. But I, you know, in no way allow you to have a say over what I do with that money. And it strikes me as just a recipe for a frayed social contract that cannot hold. Do you look at it in the same way?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think ultimately we have to understand the fundamental social contract as existing to enable all of us to live flourishing lives as free people. And that means we do have some obligations to each other. There are some things we owe one another as citizens of one society. But it also means that part of what we owe each other is a certain degree of freedom and responsibility that is best negotiated in private life. And the reason not to do this where we can avoid it in public life and in politics is that it becomes very difficult for that negotiation to take place in a way that respects other people's dignity and rights. And so ultimately, I'm a conservative who believes that limits on government are essential because I think that the rest of society is essential. And when we allow government to grow to the detriment of family and community and religion and other key institutions, we make it much harder for people to live flourishing lives.
I'd like for us to look ahead a little bit and anticipate where things might be headed, both sort of hopeful and less hopeful scenarios. To do that, though, I think we need to reflect on the idea that you're laying out here, which is that there are two parties in the United States, and it has been like that almost since its founding. Washington warned against factions in his farewell speech, but political parties emerged almost right after that. And there's always been two dominant ones. First, could you just tell us, you know, what is it about the structure of the U.S. political system that creates that seemingly inevitable outcome?
Well, there are a number of structural causes. I think actually the deepest one is one we don't think about a lot, which is the Electoral College. In order to elect a president, you have to win an absolute majority of electors in the Electoral College, which means that if there are more than two serious candidates, the election is likely to go to the House of Representatives. You're likely to end up in a place where nobody gets a majority. And that's happened twice in 1800, 1824. These were both profound legitimacy crises. And after the second time, there was really a concerted effort to avoid it happening again. And American politics organized itself in a durable way into two parties. There are other structural causes that have to do with the nature of our elections. First past the post elections for in a similar way tend to encourage there being only two serious candidates. And so I think for a lot of these reasons, the system has taken shape that way, but it's also a good fit for the American constitutional system. Because when you have two parties, each of them is inevitably going to be a coalition internally. It's not people who agree about everything. It's people who are held together by some process of negotiation. And that means that succeeding in our party politics prepares you to then succeed in American government, because coalition building and negotiating is essential for the work of Congress, for the relationship between the branches. So I think broadly, our two-party system serves our politics fairly well. It certainly has downsides, but on the whole, I think it's been good for American politics.
So, I mean, the prospect of a third party suddenly becoming a dominant force, you're not bullish on that idea. That's always, you know,
that's right.
as libertarians, we always look at the Libertarian Party with interest. It's faded over the past several cycles to become more and more marginal. I think the mm-hmm. candidate ended up getting like 0.1% of the vote or something this time. You know,
I might be understating it.
It was less than 1% of the vote, I think. That's a combination of the candidate himself and the leadership of the party kind of consciously deciding to undermine their candidate. But putting all that aside, I mean, is that whole project kind of hopeless in your view?
Well, it's not useless. It may be hopeless, but it's not useless. I think that third parties can often inject new issues and ideas into the two-party system in a way that endures. We saw Ross Perot run for president twice in the 1990s. He didn't win a single electoral vote, but he absolutely transformed our politics. And both parties learned a lot from the Perot movement about what they needed to become and what they needed to be. And so I think those kinds of third-party movements can have tremendous influence, but I don't think that they can durably persist as parties. They get eaten up by the other parties in ways that helps them matter.
So, I mean, if the reality is that there are going to be these two dominant parties and perhaps one of them will assemble a governing coalition, the best I can hope for is that the Democrats and Republicans somehow become more libertarian. And I am not feeling particularly hopeful about that. But why not?
Yeah. I mean, we just had an entire news cycle about the Department of Government Efficiency, which, yes, lots of people are maybe not so bullish on. But I mean, Vivek Ramaswamy, who very explicitly embraces like nationalist libertarianism, and who has come on our show before, and Elon Musk, who I think is an entrepreneur who has single-handedly advocated for, you know, on one hand, yes, his companies have taken advantage of all kinds of government subsidies and tax breaks. But on the other hand, he is a huge champion for getting wokeness the hell out of our politics, but also attempting to limit the size of government and allow entrepreneurs to be able to legitimately flourish. I mean, it's hard. It seems like a little bit of this trollish effort on the part of Trump. It might end up in the form of a blue ribbon commission. It might really not actually end up doing that much. But I'm sorry, this is way better than we would be getting under a Harris administration, at least lip service to cutting the size of government.
I think that's a really good point, Liz, actually. And like, it is significant that, you know, Trump did go out of his way to, in his Trumpian way, try to court libertarians and even make some specific pledges. We'll see if he follows through on any of those. But yeah, maybe let's start with the GOP, the kind of Vivek Ramaswamy libertarianish wing of the GOP is definitely a thing. How bullish are you on that?
Yeah. So look, I think that, I would say, first of all, I think creating a new government department is a strange way to make government more efficient. But it does seem to me that, as I said earlier, the Republican Party is a coalition, although it pretends not to be in the Trump era. It nonetheless is a coalition. And there is certainly a libertarian element of that coalition. You see it in some very important respects, and you've described some of them here in the Trump coalition. Its opposites are also in the Trump coalition. And again, they pretend not to be representing different sorts of views. And so you've got people who want to significantly increase the role of government. You've got people who are abjectly opposed to free market capitalism, frankly, within the Trump coalition too. And so they're going to be competing for sway, and we'll see how they do. I think that kind of competition is always going to happen in a big, broad tent of a party. And it happens a little less explicitly in the Trump era, and so a little less constructively. But certainly there's a libertarian element in the Republican coalition, and I think there will be. I mean, the case for markets is part of what American conservatism is.
Let me ask about the Democratic side of that equation. You know, I'm always amused. I always often look back at this book, which James Carville published shortly after Obama won, called 40 More Years,
mm-hmm.
The Democrats Will Rule the Next Generation. That was a little optimistic in retrospect. But, you know, if the Democrats are able to assemble a lasting coalition, my hope would be that it would, I mean, I would also think it would necessarily have to incorporate some of our concerns here. We just talked with Li Fong last episode, and his vision is a more Bernie Sanders-esque, you know, populist Democratic Party. I'm hoping things don't go that way, but where do you see things headed if the Democrats want to build that sort of lasting 40-year governing coalition in
right.
the future?
Well, look, I think there's an element of libertarianism in the Democratic Party when it comes to social and cultural issues, and
mm-hmm.
that's always been an important facet of the American left. There's also a more peculiar kind of dynamic that they have more trouble dealing with, which is the Democratic Party is increasingly the party of wealthier Americans, people who benefit from the market economy, quite frankly. And they're not willing to make the case for it, at least so far, but I do think that being the party of people who are better off in American life and who value stability more could, over time, make them a little friendlier to market economics, too. There is a kind of wing of the Democratic Party now that's talking more and more about abundance, that's sounding a little more like the supply-siders on the right in the 1980s. I don't know how far they're getting so far, but those folks certainly are deregulators in some important way and take markets seriously.
And the abundance agenda types also are very closely aligned with the YIMBY coalition, which is actually seeing a little bit more play on the national stage, which I think is a really interesting thing. I mean, we are seeing some cities, I mean, all of this, the housing related regulations happen at the state and local level, but we are even seeing some cities like Austin remedy their sort of burgeoning housing crises in part by following a more YIMBY agenda. And then we even saw this become a little bit more substantial of an issue that Kamala Harris was sort of touting in the campaign. And so I'm curious about the abundance agenda, YIMBY sort of like neoliberalish coalition. Like, will they find more of a home among the Democratic, like in the Democratic Party, or will they be kind of in this weird no man's land forever?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really remains to be seen. The case they can make for themselves is that they are likely to make the Democrats more popular with winnable voters. And that's not a small case. That's an important argument to make for yourself. It's a little harder to make in a 50-50 era, right? When neither party really feels like it's losing, it isn't really looking for how it should change so that it would win. And you see the same dynamic on the Republican side. But I think there is some intellectual energy behind the abundance folks, and we'll see if they can get anywhere with politicians on their side. There's a related dynamic, as always, on the right, where, again, I think the question is, how do you win those winnable voters? All of the durable majority coalitions in the history of the American party system have had some fundamental vision of how America will be more prosperous under them. Some idea of this is the logic of our economic policy. I think right now voters would be very hard pressed to say what either party's fundamental economic vision really is. And as long as that's the case, it'll be hard for either of them to really become a durable majority party.
Let me, we're going to wrap up by asking you the final question of the show, which we ask all our guests, which is, Yuval Levin, what is a question that you think more people should be asking?
You know, I'm always inclined to think that the questions we fail to ask are questions about what don't we have. We tend to look at our politics and say, and see what we have too much of. And it's very easy to see what we have too much of. And if you think about the kinds of issues I think about, you might say we have, there's too much presidential power, the courts are too active. I look at that and I think what we don't have enough of is Congress, for example. I think we should look at a lot of the areas where there seem to be problems in American life and say, not only what do we have too much of, but what do we not have enough of? What do we need to be building? What do we need to be doing that we're not doing? That, it seems to me, is a way to be constructive about American problems rather than purely critical.
Great. Before we wrap, I'm just going to once again remind our viewers and listeners to please subscribe to the new Just Asking Questions YouTube channel. Even if you don't normally watch us on YouTube, it will help. And if you follow us on X, you'll see the live streams of the conversations whenever they happen and have a chance to jump in with questions or comments. Thank you for watching and listening, and we will see you again next week.
Thanks for listening to Just Asking Questions. We drop a new episode every Thursday, so if you want to support the work we do, please like and share this episode, subscribe to our new YouTube channel, and follow the show on your favorite podcasting app. See you next time.